the nature of conviviality, which you touched on already a little bit, Charlotte. I thought it was very interesting that a few days ago Gay did a writing workshop here. Ostensibly it was a writing workshop, of course, about writing about food, and asked the participants to bring food to share as part of the workshop. And I'm wondering, Gay, whether you could tell us a little bit about what happened, because you didn't end up actually doing any writing, did you? You did something else.
We did quite a lot of eating, and some of those people are here, and I hope that you forgive me for not asking you to attempt to write. I asked everyone to bring food because if you're interested in writing about food, surely you must be interested in cookery. And before cookery, I think we need to be interested in agriculture. There's a wonderful American writer, poet, pivotally farmer, who's quite old now, called Wendell Berry, who I don't think is much read in Australia. Remarkable man. And one of Wendell Berry's pivotal sayings is that eating is an agricultural act. But let me go back to the workshop where we didn't write, but where we shared food. It was wonderfully convivial. We shared food without it being competitive. I brought something to start because I wanted to say welcome, which is to say that I had laboured, and I think labour is a beautiful word, that I had laboured over this very simple dish.
Can you tell us what you brought?
I made rasam, which is a wonderful soup, which is a basic southern Indian soup, which is restorative in the way chicken broth might be to someone in Europe. It's also called pepper water. It has tamarind in it, so it's slightly sour. But better food was brought, but we didn't talk about what was best and what was not as good. We simply made some wonderful gesture, generous gesture, in that we all brought food. It was.
And so you literally broke bread together, didn't you?
We did. Mm. We did.
Yeah. Now, Charlotte, can you talk a little bit about that in relation to some of the themes in your book around comfort food and food that is shared in moments of grief?
Originally, my book, I wanted really only to write about that. I wanted to write a really practical sort of hands-on book about cooking for people when they are sick or brokenhearted or bereaved or something. Because I had, when my parents died in this small little town, one of the ways that this incredible love was shown to my family was by people bringing us food, and over, you know, many months of these two separate illnesses. And I find it an incredibly moving gift because it is completely practical. It is not intrusive. There are times in our lives when there is nothing that anyone can say to make the situation better, or to, you know, just platitudes do not work in that scenario. So, you know, food would arrive and we would eat it, and it was very comforting. So, and then everyone in my family has since done that for other people. So, and I, just not long before writing the book, a good friend had had breast cancer, and I cooked a lot for her and her husband over the months of her treatment. And other people said to me, oh, but what, you know, what do you take and how do you know what they can eat and blah, blah, blah. So I wanted to just write about that. And in the end, the book, you know, became much broader and sort of celebratory as well as consoling, I hope. But I did a kind of little mini survey of friends and friends of friends about what they considered to be comfort food. And it was what you would expect. It was starchy, hot, a lot of fat and starch, basically. And it was amazing how consistent it was sort of culturally, you know, congee or tofu sometimes. but, you know, the sort of chicken broth thing across cultures was very interesting. And, you know, chicken noodle soup, etc.
Around here, of course, comfort food is most likely to mean hash cookies.
Put that in the next volume.
I just want to say I've just read Anne Tyler's latest novel. For the life of me, now that I'm sitting up here, I can't remember the title of. It's very recent. And she is a marvellously heartwarming writer. And it's about a man whose wife dies, and she reappears for him until then, of course, she disappears altogether and he realises they really didn't have a very happy marriage. His neighbours all bring pots of food to him, and he has to surreptitiously put them in the rubbish bin, tip them in the garden, put them in a pot plant. So I think the gesture is still absolutely valid.
And the gesture is enough, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things, I had a little story in my book about a neighbour of my mother's, a little old lady called Ruby, who used to come to the door every few days when my mother was really quite sick, and she would bring these little offerings of completely inedible, disgusting food. And it was lovely, you know, and so my sisters who were caring for my mother would accept it and say thank you, and it didn't matter that it was, you know, uncooked scone dough with Vegemite on it and, you know, a bit of pineapple and a sardine or something. I mean, it was quite bizarre. But it was this gesture of beauty and honesty and love, and that's enough. And so if you, you know, and I mean, I think, I hope that the recipes in my book that are about that comfort food eating are to prevent them being thrown out in the garbage. But so you can make good food as well. But I think the gesture is the most powerful part.
Absolutely.
Of that.
Mungo, can we switch for a moment to the political arena? Because one of the great things about Eat My Words is the way you bring together your experience as a political commentator, observer and journalist, and your passion for food, which I think many people won't have known about before. And you've got some wonderful anecdotes about observing people in Canberra where politics and food sort of converge. Would you like to perhaps share one of those anecdotes with us and tell us a little bit about how you see the role of eating and dining in the political sphere?
Well, of course, the political sphere doesn't leave all that much time for eating. By and large, everything's done on the run when politics is moving. And for many politicians, it's a race between one rubber chicken after another at some terrible function they have to attend. One terrible example of where politicians can be brought undone by this schedule is what I call the perpetual floating political barbecue, which is this terrible function which seems to go from state to state, from party to party, beyond all normal boundaries, and it's the ultimate political fundraiser, the barbecue. And there's only one, and it's always the same, and it always consists of burnt sausages placed on white bread. There is usually warm beer for the men and brandy and dry for the women, or there would be if anybody had remembered the dry. And occasionally there are some pallid, limp salads which unwilling political wives have been forced to prepare. If it's the evening, there's often a tent with fairy lights, some of which occasionally work. There is absolutely no sign of anything like a vegetable, with the possible exception of tomato sauce. It is, by and large, a fairly grim occasion. But on this particular one, in 1974 election, Billy Snedden, who was then leader of the Liberal Party, was doing the outback of Queensland, accompanied by the political barbecue. And at the end of one particularly gruelling evening, Billy Snedden, who had perhaps had a little bit too much of the warm beer, decided he would thank his hosts. So he said, well, first of all, of course, I've got to thank Ned for providing the wonderful venue we've had, and his lovely wife Doreen for the beautiful salads. There's old Bert who brought the beer. Good on you, Bert. And then, of course, the sound system. Well, we can thank Fred for that too. And there must be somebody I've left out. But who gives a fuck? The Liberals did not win the seat.
Mungo, I have to ask you what you made of Annabel Crabb's recent foray into bringing politics and food together in kitchen cabinets.
Fury and envy, because that was my idea, and I pitched it to the ABC about 3 years ago. The idea's not bad, but there are two things basically wrong with it, which is as the role crossing doesn't always work. I mean, there is only one thing worse than a chef posing as a celebrity, and that's a celebrity posing as a chef. And these two things should not be allowed. I mean, this is reality television at its most unreal.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything about that, Charlotte?
I only saw a couple of them. I thought it was patchy, but I did love the one with Penny Wong. And when she talked about, I think, bringing the master stock on the plane with her parents, and I thought that was really revealing. I mean, possibly because she doesn't speak much, you know, about her personal life, but I thought it was great.
Well, I wondered, Mungo, whether you thought that it could evolve so that in that particular instance we saw Annabel bring her considerable charm to a kind of one-on-one with a politician, but I was wondering whether your experience of Canberra showed whether there was any possibility of rapprochement in these very kind of difficult times that we're going through at the moment politically, where people sitting down and, as we were saying before with Gay, breaking bread together could reach some kind of harmony and some kind of consensus on something.
Well, yes, I think there is. I mean, politicians by and large are not nearly as antagonistic in the flesh as they are on television. They do have a lot in common after all, and they tend to sympathise with each other about the travails of the profession, and when they do get together over a drink or a meal or whatever, there is quite often harmony, although it's notable that they don't often discuss politics when they do it. They keep well off politics. And there have been attempts. I mean, for instance, in the old, very old days, Al Grasby, Whitlam's immigration minister, used to arrive from his Riverina home with enormous amounts of cheap wine and would turn this on as a sort of all get-together in Parliament evening, resulting in frightful scenes, which I won't actually go into in any detail here. And there have been other attempts, but very often they do end in disaster.
There's a wonderful book that Adam Gopnik wrote called The Table Comes First, which is a historical and sort of philosophical meditation on the role of food in French culture. I recommend it to all of you. It's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful book. And it opens incredibly movingly with the story of a member of the resistance who's about to be shot the next day. And before he's shot, he's allowed to write one last letter to his family. And he writes about the meals that they shared before. And he writes about the pleasure that he had in these shared meals. And I wanted to ask you each what you thought your last meal would be if you could choose it.
I'll go first because I have no last meal. I would probably listen to some music that moved me incredibly. But in a way, I think, pardon me, Caroline, I think it's a rather silly question. there is a remarkable story in one of Primo Levi's books where some men who are absolutely starving have one pot of food between them, which isn't enough to sustain them anyway. One man begins to talk about a memory of food before being in a concentration camp. And this is, I should say, a true story, not allegorical. They all begin to tell stories from their memories of food before the war and before being incarcerated by the Germans, and they forget to eat the food in the pot.
You see, it wasn't a stupid question because it got you to tell that story. And the point that I think you raised there that is so important about this letter that this resistance fighter writes is that it is about memory, exactly as your story illustrates as well. So, Charlotte, do you think it was a stupid question or do you have an answer?
I think it's a perfectly fine question. But I don't have any idea of what I would eat for my last meal because this may sound kind of, I don't know, a bit pious or something, but to me I would definitely want a meal with my people I love before I die, and it won't matter what the food is. Yeah. The occasion, the bringing together, the sharing of food, and it could be anything. I don't care.
So
and
it
I
goes
don't
back
really
to
care
that, conviviality.
That much about particular foods or, you know, it's the experience of sharing. You know, I think if some very fine dining restaurants, I don't go to very many, but every now and again I do. And I always feel a little I don't want to spend my time at an occasion with my husband or my friends concentrating on the food. I want to concentrate. I mean, I always sort of miss half of it because I start talking and then someone says, what was that we just had? You know, so that kind of obsessive attention to each mouthful of food, I think it's kind of art and theatre, but it's not what I want from going out for dinner.
Mungo.
Very easy question, actually. My last meal is the one before my next meal. I don't intend to stop eating for quite a while yet. So let's not muck around. I mean, nobody knows what the last meal's going to be. Most people die unexpectedly. You don't get a choice. I would say, you know, that's all you can say about my last meal. It's the one that's in my stomach when they do the autopsy.
On that lovely image, we do now have 10 minutes left for some questions from the audience.
I'd be really interested to know what the panel thinks about the trend towards branding of fruit and vegetables. There seems to be a trend in Australia following the American model where our produce is losing its individual identity.
Are you talking about fresh produce?
Yeah. You know, we damn America for what we also do ourselves. And in fact, in America, there are some absolutely extraordinary food shops who are doing exactly the opposite of that, and who care about where the tomato comes from and how it's grown, and the shoppers themselves are gastronomically educated and know what they're buying. There's a limit, in a way, I personally think, to how we can rail against the supermarkets. We have to do it by our actions as much as anything else. We live in a society where our food is absolutely dominated by industrial food, by packaged food. And our very middle class concern with quality and flavour and things like that is often just about status and advertisement, and it's also about what we can have because we have enough money to have it. And I think we have to, you know, this is a very bald statement, but I think the best food, really good food, should be cheaper than bad food.
One more question. Yes, the lady in the hat.
The MasterChef stuff. That is entertainment, which is about conflict and drama and tears and pressure. And I think it's, you know, it can be very amusing entertainment. And it's got nothing to do with cooking, as far as I'm concerned, at home. For television, you require drama, stress, pressure, tears, fighting, carrying on. All of that is the opposite of what I get out of cooking at home, which is a kind of peaceful engagement, a sort of groundedness in my life. It grounds me to cook something slowly, without fuss and pressure, without performance. If there's one thing that in my book that I've written, that I've had a lot of people very sweetly say, oh, it's made me feel like cooking again because I don't care about performing anymore, you know. And that is crucial, I think, to forget about performance and cooking going together.
Can I just say, in the 1970s, an Englishman named John Stuart Collis wrote a book about his experience working on farms during the Second World War. He was, in fact, an academic. The book's called The Worm Forgives the Plough. It's a wonderful book. And one of the things he says is that we make bread in order to have more than bread. And I think that most television cookery and certainly the MasterChef series is about food as an end in itself. We need more engagement with food by making bread in order to have more than bread. Food is good for thinking.
That's a great note on which to end, I have to say. We've come to the end of this slightly controversial hour. I hope you're feeling hungry for your lunch. You've certainly had some food for thought. Please join me in thanking Charlotte Wood, Gay Bilson and Mungo McCallum.